Hello, this is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome all of you to our first ever diabetes mini-series. This is very exciting for us because we're offering 5 online courses that really tell a story about diabetes. We're kicking it off today. We're going to be talking about pathophysiology, what's broken with diabetes. We'll talk about the different types of diabetes. And throughout this program, we're going to be integrating some case studies and really discussing about diabetes and behavior change, because you can understand diabetes, you can know the pathophysiology and the science, but if the patient doesn't really take it to heart and take the information and translate it into behavior change, outcomes don't improve. So as we go through this program, I'll be talking a lot about how do we approach patients to help them succeed, because truly diabetes is a self-managed condition. And that's going to be a main focus of this program as we reach out to people that we work with, our patients, our colleagues, who are living with either pre-diabetes or diabetes or at risk for either. As diabetes educators, we're going to really expand our outreach to more than just our patients, but hopefully to our communities, because it is such a serious epidemic. So if you're just joining us, thank you so much for coming along on this journey, this diabetes journey. This is Beverly Tomasian, and I am the president of Diabetes Education Services. It's a consulting company that I've had the joy and pleasure of running for the past 15 years. And the main goal of my company is to provide information, resources, tools, courses to people and healthcare professionals who are interested in diabetes and want to learn as much as they can about it. So our courses and our websites are all designed to support your efforts to provide excellence in diabetes care. And I always, love ideas for improvement, or if I need to post more articles or you have some ideas to make it better, I want to know about it. So thank you so much for joining us, and let's go ahead and get started. As I've mentioned before, the handouts are available. We sent you an email, but if you, for some reason, you didn't get that email, you can go to our website, diabetesed.net, and then you go to the online courses tab, mini series, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and I put a link there that says Your Diabetes Resources for Miniseries. And that you can click on there, and you'll see there's a whole page of information, including a PDF of this handout that you can download. And also, I've put other articles and links, and I'll keep adding to that. And if, as I mentioned, if you think of any links that would be helpful for our audience, I would love to see them. And, we're joined by people from across the country. And so all of you do diabetes a little bit differently. Maybe you have some special tips or ways that you do things. I would like to make this a sharing opportunity so we can use that page as a resource for all of us to support our efforts to provide the best diabetes care. So I've talked about the first bullet point on this slide. We will send you a link for each broadcast. So each broadcast has its own unique link. So save those in your inbox in a folder, and then each week you'll click on those to join this program. You can check in 5 to 10 minutes before the program, but if you're running late, you have a patient, there's an emergency, you can join us at any time. And then after this program is done, we're going to have a recorded version of it. We'll send you a link to the recorded version, but it will be posted on our Diabetes Education University .com website. There is our online library. You could click on it, listen to it anytime, and also the handouts and resources will be there. To receive CE credit for this program, you need to log into your Education University Student Center. So you just need your email address and your password, and then you choose this course, a mini series, and then you take the post-test and a survey, and then your certificate is there to print out. So it's really easy. Once you get familiar with it, it's a very easy process to do. So we do have post-test questions for each of these mini-series that I personally write, and so I try to make them really relevant to the topics that we're talking about, and I really try and highlight key information. So here's what we're going to talk about today: describe the impact of diabetes, we're going to talk about pathophysiology, we're going to provide some updates on the different types of diabetes, and we'll be doing a lot of case study, and we'll discuss how to really reach out to people to make this education meaningful to them and effective as far as promoting behavior change. And before we get started with the actual content, I really would love to know a little bit more about you all. And I'm just going to ask you a question. What is your profession? And if your profession is not listed on here, I only have space for five. You can just go ahead and type it in the chat room, and then we could see what your profession is. And you can choose more than one. So if you're already have you're a dietitian and a CDE or a pharmacist and a CDE, you can choose both of those. This is the best part. I love this poll function. I only can do eight polls, so if I was to write this software program, I would include at least 15 polls. All right. Thank you so much. I'm going to go ahead and close this and share this with all of you. So you can see over half of you are nurses, many dietitians, some pharmacists, and 20% of you are CDE. So you already are a certified diabetes educator. So excellent. Okay, good. And I think this information is relevant to all professions, and whether you're a CDE or you don't have your CDE yet, it's very applicable. And then I'm asking another question. What best describes, you could choose more than one, why you joined this presentation or why you signed up for this diabetes mini series? Okay, it looks like I had some typographical errors on this poll. So, thank you for attempting to answer this. Sometimes, you type things up, they don't really come up as you had intended to. But I really appreciate that, your answers. I'm going to go ahead and close this. And this is really the main question I wanted to know the answer to. How many of you out there are working towards your CDE? And a lot of you are, 62%. So as I go through this webinar, that gives me a lot of good information. I'll focus on key issues to know for the CDE exam and some key aspects of that. And as I talk about the exam, I'm also going to really focus on best practice. As diabetes educators, what is the best practice and what should we know to provide the best care to our patients? And then 95% of you said, yeah, I want to update in the latest in diabetes care and education. And that's what we're really going to provide. I do a lot of work behind the scenes researching and making sure that all my information is the latest. Okay, so let's get started, and now you can look at your handout, and we can just go through this content, and we have an hour and a half, and I'll try to appropriate the right amount of time to this content, and as time allows, I'll answer any questions. So many times after the end of a webinar, I'll stop and just turn off the recording button, and we'll just do a question and answer session. I'm very happy to do that, but during the program, I'll try and answer some questions too. So here's the statistic that keeps me awake at night, and I keep thinking this can't be right, that 35% of Americans will have diabetes by the year 2050. How could that be right? Right now, our numbers are a lot different than that. So that is a tremendous increase in a chronic condition that's associated with many complications, and the biggest complication associated with diabetes is heart disease, cardiovascular disease, stroke, heart attack. And we know that it's really causing a lot of issues from a quality of life perspective too. So as diabetes educators, concerned citizens, family members, I want to reach out to all of you to say, what can we do to slow down this epidemic? And here are my two boys, and my older boy, Robert, right there, just graduated sixth grade and is moving on to junior high. And there's my little guy, my nine-year-old. And it's pretty shocking that by the time they are 50, one-third of their friends, colleagues, family members will have diabetes. So that is an alarming statistic. And when I think of my boys as they, move into adulthood, that their friends and colleagues and the people they hang out with were going to be living with diabetes at a much higher rate, and is really unnerving to me. And so this is why I keep working on diabetes education and sharing this information. It's really a call to action for me to say we need to do something, and actually health people in the healthcare professions have special tools. We're very knowledgeable about diabetes and science, and we know how to speak the language, and plus we're passionate. We wouldn't be in healthcare if we didn't have that passion. So I really appreciate your attention to this crisis. So as I was mentioning, 35% of people will have diabetes by the year 2050, and you can see now only 8% have diabetes. So about 1 in 10 have diabetes right now, and we're going to go to 1 in 3. The other thing I worry about a lot is that this stat, that 79 million people have prediabetes. And what I like to do now is ask you, what is prediabetes? So let me go ahead and launch this poll. How would we define it based on the American Diabetes Association criteria? Okay. Thank you so much for voting, everybody. Usually during my live courses, I play a game called Diabetes Bingo. So this is kind of our questions for my Diabetes Bingo, actually. Okay, we'll take one more second. Thank you so much. Let me close this poll. So what most of you said is that pre-diabetes is a fasting blood sugar level of 100 to 125. You're absolutely right. So it's not any blood sugar above 99, because once that blood sugar fasting hits a certain criteria, that rolls over to diabetes. So pre-diabetes, a fasting blood sugar of 100 to 125, and 79 million people have that. So here's my worry, is that many of those people with pre-diabetes are going to roll over to diabetes. This is, if you really want to know the truth, this is 1 in 3 people in America right now have prediabetes. And I wrote a newsletter recently saying, why don't we call prediabetes stage 1 diabetes? Because it is true that when you have prediabetes, you're looking at an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. So even before you reach the diagnosis of diabetes, the rate of cardiovascular disease dramatically goes up, even with prediabetes. And so sometimes I think, using that word pre-diabetes, we're like, oh, no big deal, they don't have diabetes yet, but it really is a big deal. And if you ever want to look at my previous newsletters on my website, I have a link of all my past newsletters. You can check that out, because it's a real big issue that we need to look at. Our kids are suffering with type 2 diabetes. So these are children who are getting type 2 diabetes when they're 14, 15, 16. And if you imagine having to live with a chronic disease for, 50, 60, 70 years is difficult. So we want to really push diabetes till later in life so you don't have to live with it as long. These kids who are getting type 2 diabetes in their teenage years are going on dialysis in their 20s. So this is a crisis. And you can see we know who the highest risk are. There's a study called it Today 2. And what they've done is they've reached out and really evaluated in our population what is the current percent of kids with type 2 diabetes. And you can see it's pretty low, less than 1%. But we want to find these kids and make sure they get appropriate treatment so they can prevent complications. And I think this last bullet point is really interesting. In the Today trial, one of their concluding statements is environmental changes are urgently needed to decrease this epidemic of diabetes. And, you know, when you think about environmental changes, what does that mean? And we'll talk about that in a few slides. We know that America is not the only place struggling with diabetes. China and Japan and India are seeing tremendous increases in the prevalence of diabetes. And this is as the cultures and the economies move from agrarian and farming to more city dwelling. They're getting less exercise, they're eating more fast food, they're moving away from their traditional food, and they're becoming more overweight. As a matter of fact, for the first time in history, there's more overweight people than underweight people globally. We have more access to food. Food is cheaper. When food becomes cheaper and more accessible, people get heavier. And this is what we're struggling with now. And you can see there's a big impact. Type 2 diabetes usually happens around 40s, where people are in the workforce and engaged in the workforce. And so these people may suffer complications and really struggle with their diabetes for many years if we need to take some action. World Diabetes Day is November 14th, and I love this poster that was put out by the United Nations trying to find people with diabetes, and you can see it from that picture. It's the signs of diabetes, frequent urination, thirst, losing weight without trying. So if anybody ever tells you, I'm losing weight without trying, I don't know about you, but I've never known anyone to lose weight without trying. So if they're doing that, I'm worried that their blood sugars are high. They're spilling sugar. That's why they're losing weight. In March, the American Diabetes Association has a Sound the Alert Day. It's a different day in every year in March. But that's our time where we reach out to our community, to our workplace. I always set up an employee blood sugar screening at our hospital, and I just have them as they're coming out of the cafeteria. I'm like, let me check your blood sugar. We want to find those people who have diabetes and don't know it. November 14th is World Diabetes Day, and these are beautiful posters that you can download. And you can see this, go to worlddiabetesday.org. And I think this is so compelling because they say in these posters, the right education for all. So yes, getting out and talking about exercise, healthy food, limiting, you know, junk foods, all of those things are so important. But then they also say the right environment for all. And I just was really looking at this picture the other day, and I noticed the educator is not standing up, towering above the people. The educator is actually sitting down. And I think this is very important as we reach out to people, and we want to make sure they feel invited, part of the conversation, part of the solution, and that they have knowledge and skills that they can enact. And we're going to help them find those knowledge and skills and take some action. Because study after study shows people know what they need to do, but do they take action? They may or may not. And that environment can influence their ability to take action. The other thing that is really compelling to me is this whole zip code study. And this is a project done by the California Endowment, but I would encourage you to go to this website, measureofamerica.org. You can type in your zip code where you live and look at the demographics of your population. What's the average income? What's the different ethnicities in your population? And then you can look at their health disparities. And this is so interesting and poignant for us that this little boy, if he's born in Stockton, and if you don't know where Stockton is in California, it's a farming community. There's a lot of immigrants, and they have lower socioeconomic status. They're really struggling on just getting, you know, food on their plate. He's only going to live till 73, but if he's born in the more affluent town of Irvine, where there's a lot of resources, there's, you know, a lot of wealth in that community, he's going to live a lot longer. So why should the same kid with the same genetic, you know, birthright or birth issues and or imprint actually live longer or shorter based on where they're born? So this is where we're talking about the health disparities associated with economics, and that's where we're trying to really focus in on that and provide resources to those high-risk communities. And we also know that diabetes isn't fair. It doesn't affect all peoples equally. You can see that the Native American, Alaska Native, Blacks, Hispanic, and Asian Americans have a higher risk of type 2 diabetes. And you can also see that Native Hawaiians and Japanese Filipino residents in Hawaii have a much higher risk. So we know that genetics, you know, from way back and beyond, you know, thousands and thousands of years influence the risk of expression of type 2 diabetes and also type 1 diabetes. So diabetes isn't fair. It affects certain people more than others. And so we want, as we, you know, put forth resources, we want to think where are the most highly affected populations and provide them with the resources they need. The other thing I was thinking about a lot is children. And with Michelle Obama's Let's Move initiative, she's really saying this very message. Let's keep our kids healthy so as they move into adulthood, they'll have less chance of having a chronic disease like diabetes. And so as, especially when I think about women, if a little girl grows up as to become a woman and gets pregnant, if she's overweight or obese when she becomes pregnant, she's much more likely to get gestational diabetes. And because she has gestational diabetes, her child is much more likely to have diabetes and obesity. So if we could really reach out to kids and help them keep healthy before they move into adulthood, help them learn those behavior strategies to succeed at healthy eating and exercise, it can be so meaningful. And actually, there's a lot of legislation. I was just listening to the news today on this where, and the schools now, they're encouraging or they really have mandates to provide healthy foods to kids. And guess what? The kids are saying, I like bananas now. I like fruits and vegetables. So when kids are exposed to it, they become more likely to continue that behavior for the rest of their life. So looking at lifestyle for kids, limiting screen time, 1 hour a day, really encouraging exercise during that 1 hour, and healthy snacks, and then looking at the environment around. Well, let's get down to the nitty-gritty now. Let's talk about diabetes. We really I really wanted to spend time talking about the epidemic and what's causing and driving this epidemic of diabetes, because I want to encourage you in any way that you can think of in your communities, how can we make a dent with this diabetes epidemic? But now what I'd like to spend some time talking about are the different types of diabetes. And I first like just to talk about normal pathophysiology of the pancreas. And I'm going to actually do a daring move right now, and I'm going to turn on my webcam, and I'm going to show you how I demonstrate diabetes using my pancreas. Hello, everyone. And I just want to make, I want to see, make sure you can all see me. So here I am. It's hot out, so I have this, little a dress on today. So anyways, for those of you who are joining the recorded version, you can't see the webcast, but I put a link on there where you can see me demonstrating the use of the pancreas. So this is a pancreas. Now, your pancreas isn't this big. Your pancreas is about the size of two fingers, and it sits underneath your liver, but it's working 24/7. Now, if you look on your pancreas, here are the beta cells. These green cells are the beta cells. Now, these beta cells are hard at work releasing insulin, and we'll talk about that more. But you see these little tiny cells right here? These are your alpha cells. The alpha cells release glucagon. Glucagon raises your blood sugar. So let's just kind of go over this. I eat food. Let's just say I had toast with almond butter for breakfast this morning, and as the toast was broken down in my stomach, my blood sugars rose. And as my blood sugars rose, my pancreas said, "Holy mackerel, I better get to work." So my pancreas, let me just get this in the center here, just squirted out a bunch of insulin. That's the job of the pancreas, to squirt out insulin when my blood sugars rise. So let me put my pancreas down for a moment. And I'm going to get out my cell. So here's a cell in my body. This cell is the liver or muscle cell. That's where most of the glucose is utilized and stored as glycogen in liver and muscle. So here is that sugar from my toast this morning, and it's floating around in my bloodstream, and it wants to get into my cell. What does it need to get into my cell? You all know this. Insulin. Well, thank goodness. Here it is. Thank goodness my pancreas was working well, and I squirted out enough insulin. So now the insulin binds to the cell. The cell opens up and sugar is utilized by my cell. Fancy word for that is called glucose disposal. So here's how it's supposed to work. Let's just go over that one more time. Here's my pancreas. I ate cereal or toast for breakfast. My pancreas squirted out insulin. The sugar is floating around in my bloodstream from that meal. The sugar wants to get into my cell. How does it do that? Insulin. Insulin binds to the cell. Cell opens up. Sugar gets in, and that's called glucose disposal. This is how my blood sugars come down, when glucose goes from my sugar into my cells. So let's just see if I have type 2 diabetes, what happens? Remember, the other side of the pancreas has a full, complete array of beta cells. This side has half. Let me see if I can get a good picture. See? When you have diabetes, you make a lot less insulin. If you have type 1 diabetes, you have no beta cells. Type 2, you have about 50% less beta cells with pre-diabetes, but when you move to diabetes, only 20% of your beta cells are still working to squirt out insulin. So now I ate that toast, and my blood sugars are rising, and here's my pancreas, squirting just a little bit. It can't squirt out enough insulin. Here's the sugar in my bloodstream. It wants to get into my cell, but you know what? There's not enough insulin. So the pancreas just cannot make enough. The sugar stays in my bloodstream. That's what diabetes is. You don't make enough insulin, so the sugar stays in your bloodstream, and the level of sugar rises and rises. And really, I tell patients, when your sugar's 300 and 400, it's like your sugar and the blood is like honey. Your blood is thick and gooey. It can't get to where it needs to go as far as circulation, and you're much more likely to get clots in that situation. And so let me just wrap up with this. The main goal when we're teaching patients about lowering their blood sugar is we want to open up the cell and get sugar in. That's what we want to do. So there's three ways we can open up the cell to get sugar in. The first way, losing weight. Now, do you have to get back to what you weighed when you got married for the first time? No, you don't have to lose that much weight. Just losing about 5 to 10% of your current body weight. So if I weigh 200 and I lost about 10 pounds, my cells open up a lot better and utilize glucose, 10 pounds. So a lot of my patients say, oh, Bev, I want to lose 100 pounds. I'm like, okay, that's a great long-term goal. Let's just start with 10. Because when you lose 10, your cells become much more insulin sensitive. And I've seen this over and over again. I just had a gentleman come to see me, and he got off his insulin. He got off his Actose. He got off his Invokana because he was exercising at least an hour a day, and he really cut back on his intake of food. Okay, so that's the second thing. I gave the answer away. The second way to open up your cell is exercise. Exercise makes you more insulin sensitive and the patient more insulin sensitive, not just for the time they're exercising, but for about 24 to 48 hours after exercise. Exercise is one of the best medications out there. It will lower the blood sugar, open up the cells, especially the muscle cells, because you know muscle is sugar, a sugar hog. Muscle needs sugar to thrive and live, and your brain needs a lot of sugar too, but muscle in particular. So when you activate your muscle cells through lifting weights, through exercise, through walking, through bowling, through gardening, through dancing, opens up your cells. So to get these cells open and get sugar in, losing 5 to 10% of the body weight, exercising 30 minutes a day, and the third thing is medications. Medications help to open up the cell and get sugar in. So, type 2 diabetes, here's a normal pancreas. Pancreas is broken. Only 20% of the beta cells are pumping out insulin. So when you eat food, turns into sugar, pancreas is trying to squirt out enough insulin, it can't do the job. Sugars rise, and the sugar cannot get into the cell. Okay, well, thanks for joining me live on my webcam. I'm going to put this on hold now so we can keep looking at the rest of the program. Let's see, somebody has a question. Oh, so Brandy asks, isn't it true that diabetes starts out as too much insulin being produced due to low insulin sensitivity? Okay, well, initially, it is true. This little pancreas realizes that the blood sugars are high. So you know what it does? It over-secretes insulin because of insulin resistance. So thanks for that great question, Brandy. So initially, as my blood sugars are on the rise, my little pancreas goes into overtime. And it says, man, those blood sugars are high. I better squirt out twice and three times the normal amount to try and overcome that hyperglycemia. And that's due to insulin resistance. But I just wanted to show you this amazing picture. So I showed you with my different teaching tools what diabetes looks like. And I do want to say something that we sell these, the pancreas and the diacel, on our website. And we sell it because we know that it's helped so many educators really get that message across of what is diabetes. And actually, the money raised to sell the pancreases goes to a charity organization called Just One Person. They make the pancreases for us, and that money goes right back to those girls in Kenya to help them go to college and so forth. But okay, so this is a really great picture. See those little blue spheres? Well, those are insulin molecules. That's what your insulin looks like. These little yellow images, like little ghosts, are the receptors. These are insulin receptors, and then you can see the insulin molecules are binding with them. And this is what's happening on the cell surface. People with type 2 diabetes have plenty of insulin receptors, and the insulin does bind, but it doesn't activate what we call the post-receptor activation, where there's this series of chemical reactions that should take place inside the cell. With type 2 diabetes, they don't. Even though the insulin's there, even though the insulin binds, there's post-receptor defects that stop that from happening. So, and of course, if you have type 1 diabetes, you make no insulin whatsoever. So just a review of what I've just said. Insulin released from the beta cells really is a storage hormone. It's going to take glucose and store it in the muscle and the liver. And it's going to halt the breakdown of glycogen in your liver, which is really important. But it also helps not only synthesize and store sugar, but also fat and protein. So insulin will take amino acids and put them together as proteins for storage. And it will also take fat and store it. And you know what? I want to be honest with you. You've noticed a lot of people with type 2 diabetes have high triglyceride levels. That's because their fat cells are insulin resistant, because fat cells use insulin to store triglycerides. So if my fat cells don't respond to insulin, my triglyceride levels go up. And you'll notice sometimes that's the first way we find that people have diabetes. Triglyceride levels are sky high, especially post-meal, because they have insulin resistance or they don't make enough of it. Triglycerides stay in the bloodstream and increase risk for cardiovascular disease. But I do want to say that beta cells have a friend, and their friend is called amylin. Amylin is secreted in 1-to-1 ratio with insulin, and this hormone helps promote satiety and slows gastric emptying. And you could see type 1s make none, and type 2s make less than normal amounts. So we do have a synthetic version of this we'll be talking about in an upcoming program called Semlin. Semlin imitates this hormone. It's a synthetic version. And it can be used mostly for people with type 1 on insulin or people on insulin therapy in conjunction to help lower blood sugars. So we have insulin and amylin lowering blood sugars. And what do we have raising blood sugars? Well, I showed you on that pancreas. We have the alpha cells of the pancreas. They release glucagon. Now, glucagon is a really important hormone because you know why? It raises blood sugars when you're too low. So if I haven't eaten for a while, if I'm having a hypoglycemic reaction, my pancreas will release glucagon. And that tells my liver, liver, there's an emergency out here, release some sugar. But when you have type 2 diabetes, people with type 2 over-release glucagon, especially all night long. So they release glucagon during the sleeping hour, and they wake up with high morning blood sugars. I know you've seen that, where patients say, I didn't eat anything past midnight, and my morning blood sugars are so high. It is not their fault. It is their pancreas's fault, releasing too much glucagon, stimulating the liver to release its glycogen stores. And I will say right now, one of the best ways to stop this from happening is to have people walk after dinner. If they're having high morning blood sugars, sure, we can use metformin also. Metformin is another helpful tool. But if they can just take a 10-minute walk after dinner, get up, move around, that really seems to help suppress this glucagon release and lower morning blood sugars. So have them check it out. And so here's the interactive component of our presentation. And then I want you to figure out how do these hormones affect blood sugar? What does glucagon do to blood sugar? Yep, you're right, it raises it. What is stress hormones? So if I'm under stress and I'm sick or I have an infection, I release those corticosteroid hormones from the adrenal cortex of my kidney. Those raise blood sugars. And you'll see patients who are infected or in a stress state, their blood sugars are very high, and they may need twice or three times their amount of insulin normally. I just had a gal who came into my class yesterday, and she had a poison oak all over her body. Boy, did she release some stress hormones. Her blood sugars went really high. So when the body is under attack, it releases epinephrine, stress hormones that make you more insulin resistant. So those patients will see blood sugars really jump up. Okay, so we have three hormones that raise blood sugars. Do we have any hormones that help lower it? We do. We have insulin. Insulin lowers blood sugar. We have amylin. And we have one more. I haven't mentioned that, and that's our gut hormones. Now, the gut hormones are really cool because every time you eat, they're released from the L cells of your intestines. So when I say gut hormones, they also mean GLP-1. So GLP-1 is a type of gut hormone. It's the most prolific gut hormone in our intestines. And I would like to say that many times we just think of our intestines as a digestive organ, but really we're understanding now that our intestines are an endocrine organ, and they release a lot of hormones that influence blood sugars, insulin resistance, all kinds of stuff. So your intestines, that 1 mile of tubing, super important. Okay, so we eat food. I just want to go over the normal physiology, what happens. Our intestines release the GLP-1, the gut hormone. That gut hormone tells your pancreas, better release some sugar. We've got food coming down the pike. And it also stops the pancreas from making glucagon after a meal. You know, when people have diabetes, they squirt out too much glucagon after foods. So this hormone calms down the pancreas, and it says, pancreas, release insulin, don't release glucagon. And this results in the liver pumping out less sugar, and you get more satiety, slower gastric emptying. And actually, this gut hormone affects the satiety center of the brain. It says, hey, you're full. You don't need to eat anymore. People with type 2 diabetes make a lot less of this gut hormone, half of it. People with type 1 also may make less. There's some interesting research on that that I'll talk about later in an upcoming webinar. But I do want to mention at this point bariatric surgery. Many of our patients with bariatric surgery and the American Diabetes Association does say that we can consider bariatric surgery for patients with diabetes who are morbidly obese with other comorbidities. And it is true that you'll hear patients say, man, I had a bariatric surgery, my diabetes went away. Well, it doesn't really go away, it goes into remission. And what does remission mean? Well, we define remission as you no longer require medications to manage your blood sugars. That's what remission is. So the diabetes is still there, the gene is activated, but the blood sugars no longer require medications to get them in target. So you can see about 40 to 95% of people with bariatric surgery have normalization of their blood sugar immediately. I mean, it's just shocking. Like within, you know, days, their blood sugars are normalized. And there's better results with people who have more beta cell mass. The more beta cell mass they have, the earlier they are with their diabetes or the shorter length they've had diabetes, the better the outcome. But look what the reason is. It's because after bariatric surgery, they have an increase in the gut hormones. So if you look at their gut hormone levels, they jump up substantially by rerouting the digestive system. We don't know why, but it's giving scientists a lot of information, maybe of doing less radical surgeries of rerouting the intestines to increase gut hormones. That increase in gut hormone has a profound effect on lowering blood sugars. And we'll be talking about these medications, incretin mimetics or gut hormone, synthetic gut hormone that we can inject in our fifth program that imitate our own natural gut hormones. And that's the Byetta, the Bydureon, Victoza, and there's a new one out there too. So we'll talk more about that. And so what I'd like to do now is just release another poll. And my next question is, diabetes is a random glucose of what? Random glucose. How would we define it? So random glucose means we just check it any time of day. It's not relative to time at all. You just walked in and I said, let me check your blood sugar. That's what we consider a random blood sugar. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close a poll. Most of you have voted. Thank you so much. And if anybody listening, I know many of you are thinking about taking the exam. You definitely want to know the diagnostic criteria for prediabetes, diabetes, gestational diabetes, which we'll get to in a moment. And on your resource page, I did put a link to the diagnostic criteria for diabetes. You could download that, print it out. It's a one page that summarizes a lot of great information. But know that for the exam. But also, it's when I say know this for the exam, it's really important to know for our patient care, for all people in diabetes education. And so the correct answer, 65% of you got it right, is a random glucose of 200 or greater equals diabetes. Yes. 140 to 199 is prediabetes. That would be a random diagnostic criteria for prediabetes. But for diabetes, 200 or greater. And when I say these numbers, I do want to clarify that you have to repeat the test on a different day to confirm diagnosis of diabetes, unless, of course, you know, the number is 500, then you know, yeah, that's diabetes. And so this next chart kind of summarizes the natural history of diabetes, and I think this is a great visual that walks us through. So let's just kind of take an imaginary person. They're born to maybe they have a parent, one of their parents has type 2 diabetes, so they have the genetic risk, and they're born, and upon birth, their pancreas has a normal functionality. Their blood sugar fasting is less than 100, random if we check their blood sugar, less than 140, and their A1C, which is a 3-month average, is less than 5.7. So what if this kid kind of grows up and then he goes to college? Now, you know right away when you go to college what happens to your weight. Maybe not for all of you, but for some of us. It used to be the freshman 5, but now it's a freshman 15. So this kid goes to college. He's not exercising as much anymore. And then he graduates, or she, with a computer science degree. So now she has a sit-down job. So she sits down a lot, and she's put on some weight, you know, since high school. And then she has a family. And so after she has this family, she's not able to exercise as much, and her weight's going up even more. So she goes to the doctor. Maybe she's in her 30s or 40s, and she sees that she's in prediabetes. Pre-diabetes is when 50% or less of your pancreas is working, 50%. So her blood sugar fasting would be ranging from 100 to 125, random 140 to 199. Her A1C about 5.7 to 6.4. So at this point, she's going to make a very important decision. Am I going to take action to go back? Because you can see by my arrows, if you take action, you can go back to normal blood sugars. If you don't take action, you're going to walk toward diabetes. Once you get to diabetes, you see how I have the no on the going back arrow? You can't go back. So many patients say to me, Bev, if I just lose weight and exercise, will my diabetes go away? And I have to say, it's not going to go away, but certainly you can control it. You can manage it. So you don't get rid of it once it expresses, but you can manage it. And here's a diagnostic criteria for diabetes. And you can see at this point, only 20% of the pancreas is working when you have diabetes. And that's true for a lot of organs. When they're only at 20% of their normal functionality, that's when disease expresses itself. Development of type 2 diabetes happens over years or decades. So you could see I was talking about this woman over her lifespan. It's probably a 10 to 20 year process where her blood sugars are on the rise. And we know from the Nurses Health Study that even women who have this range of prediabetes have almost a doubling of the rate of incidence of heart attack and stroke as young women. So this is a call to action. No matter where you work, if you work in a hospital or a clinic and you see people in that pre-diabetes range, we want to reach out to them and say, hey, let's make some changes. And I'll talk about what changes they can make to help prevent progression to diabetes. Now, you're at you know, Thanksgiving dinner with your Aunt Emma, and your Aunt Emma sits next to you, and she says, honey, I know you're in the healthcare field, and I just want to let you know I'm getting a lot of vaginal yeast infections. What? Why do you think that is? And you're like, Aunt Emma, that's just too much information. But then you're thinking, yeah, she's a little bit older and she's in her 60s. And as we know, type 2 diabetes is more common in older people. So after the age of 64, over 20 to 25% of people have diabetes. So we know she has a 1 in 4 chance of having it. Now she's telling us about signs of diabetes. And so here are some classic signs that I'm always looking for. Weight loss without trying, and then infections, like people getting boils or abscesses, or they keep getting sick a lot, or vaginal yeast or urinary tract infections. That's because there's too much sugar in your blood. When there's too much sugar in your blood, the bacteria can thrive for two reasons. A, your white blood cells don't work as well when there's a lot of sugar in your blood. And B, sugar feeds bacteria. It's like a party. It's a bacterial party going on, or a yeast party. And they just flourish in that environment. So I'm always looking for infections as signs of diabetes. Especially, you'll see a lot of our patients with diabetes have fungal infections, toes. A lot of toenail fungal infections. So look, if you see people with infections, you don't really understand why did they get an infection. They really shouldn't have gotten this. Look at their blood sugars. And I want to tell you the other thing. About 20% of all people with diabetes don't know they have it. And so lots of people say, well, these are just, you know, I'm just getting older. That's why I'm more tired. I can't see as well. It's not a sign of getting older. You know, when you get older, you should still feel great. So if they're complaining of those signs, have them check their blood sugar. Okay, we're going to talk now about type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And let's see, I have another question, so let's see if I can answer that. If diabetes goes into remission, does the pancreas increase in function, or will it still say about 20%? Oh, that's a great question. So what if you have diabetes and your blood sugar, we've detected it, can you protect that 20%? Yeah, you don't usually grow new beta cells from the research that we currently have. There might be some regeneration, but it doesn't seem like it's very profound. But the thing I do tell my patients is that you could protect the beta cells you have left. That's really important. So you want to prevent glucose toxicity and get your blood sugars as close to target, and that can really help to preserve beta cells. So high blood sugars burns them out more quickly. Lower blood sugars, your beta cells can thrive in that environment. So keep as close to target as possible. Okay, let's talk about the different types of diabetes and see where we go there. Because this is, you know, such important information. We have a 5'8" male. He weighs 192 pounds. He's had diabetes for 12 years. He's been on insulin for 3 years. What type of diabetes does he have, and how do you know? Well, what we know about this gentleman is that he's probably has type 2 diabetes, and I'll tell you, I usually like ask this question live so I can hear your feedback, but what we do know about him is that if he had type 1 diabetes, he would have been on insulin for 12 years. When you have type 1, you're on insulin from the moment you're diagnosed. But we know that since he's only been on insulin for 3 years, for the first 9 years, probably he was managed through nutrition and oral medications, but his pancreas just kind of burned out, and now he needs insulin. So a lot of people say, well, that means I've got the bad kind of diabetes. No, it doesn't mean that. It just means your pancreas isn't making enough insulin, so we need to replace it with a hormone called insulin. Now, what about this gal? She's 5'6". Oh, wait, I just want to finish up with case study one. So we would say he's a type 2 requiring insulin. That's his official title. What about this gal? 5'6", weighs 108 pounds. On insulin, 3 units of Novolog before meals, 10 units of Lantus at bedtime. So we know from a lot of different reasons that she has type 1. Number one, she's lean. So if you look at her BMI and her body weight, for 5'6", she's on definitely the leaner side. And so usually when we think about type 1, they're usually more lean as compared to a type 2 who would be more heavy set. And then we look at her insulin dose. You can tell she's insulin sensitive because she only needs 3 units of Novolog before meals. And Novolog is a fast-acting insulin, and 10 units of Lantus at bedtime. If she had type 2, it would be more like 8 units of Novolog before meals, 10 units of Novolog before meals. Type 1s are much more insulin sensitive because they don't resist insulin. They just don't make it. So they just suck up the insulin. So this is very clearly somebody with type 1 diabetes. And so let's talk about the different types of diabetes. And let me just take a look at where I'm at on my handout. Okay, good. We're right on track. Now, this photo is a hard photo to look at. It was taken in the year 1920. And this little boy had type 1 diabetes. So his pancreas has been completely destroyed. He doesn't make insulin. And so what happens when he eats food, it turns into glucose. And the glucose cannot get into his muscle. The glucose cannot get into his liver. Instead, the glucose is just urinated out. Without insulin, you can't store glucose. So he has a wasting syndrome. And you can see he has no muscle mass. He's used all of his fat for fuel. And that's what diabetes ketoacidosis is, when you use fat for fuel because you can't use glucose. And that is a life-threatening situation. So in the 1920s, to keep these little kids alive, they would put them on 400 and 500 calorie diets just to pray that there would be some medication they could take in the future to sustain their life or some treatment. And the great news about this picture is that this little boy lived. And this is not him. This is not him, but I'll show you a picture of him on class. I think it's class 3 or 4. You'll see a picture of that little boy who did live, because he received insulin therapy. This is Gary Hall, and Gary Hall, an Olympic swimmer, type 1 diabetes, who won gold medals in Australia and Greece. So type 1 doesn't stop anybody from doing anything. We really have improved outcomes with type 1 diabetes. They're living a lot longer. They're having less complications because we really have identified best management strategies, and that's through the Diabetes Control and Complications Trial, which we'll discuss next class. But the truth is, when we think about diabetes rates and type 1 versus type 2, even type 1 diabetes rates are on the rise. We've seen a 23% rise over the past 10 years. And why is that? We're not really sure, but we're thinking there's changes in the environment. Maybe there's less good bacteria. We're killing off all the good bacteria. Maybe we're just too clean. We know that kids exposed who grow up on farms, or kids who live in third world countries who don't have access to a lot of hygiene, have a lot less type 1 diabetes. So maybe we're just like over-sanitizing everything and depriving our body of bacteria that work synergistically with us, that have been a part of our existence for thousands and thousands of years. We're wiping them out. And so one thought is that our immune system is like bored. It's like, what am I doing? No, they're not introducing anything into me, so I might as well just start attacking myself. So that's a very, oversimplified version, but there is some studies using worms, and it's called hemlin therapy, introducing worms like hookworms into the intestine. And guess what? It seems to decrease autoimmune response because the body has something to attack besides itself. And then obesity. So you're thinking, wait, obesity is type 2. Why does she have it on type 1? Well, our kids are getting heavier, and even heavy kids get type 1 diabetes. So maybe that extra strain on the pancreas is causing expression of type 1 diabetes. We don't really know. But here are some facts that there are kids every day getting diagnosed with diabetes, 80 people per day, and the rate is going up annually. So when we think about type 1 diabetes, it represents 10% of all diabetes. It's a combination of genes and environment. So what genes do your parents have that they provide to you? And then environmental exposure. And we're trying to figure out what is that environmental exposure. And you can see at the very bottom here, I've listed some viral triggers that we think may activate type 1 diabetes if you're at risk, like rubella and the Coxsackie, B virus, cytomegalovirus, and adenovirus in mumps. So these might be viruses that if you are at risk for type 1, you're exposed to them, it switches the autoimmune response on. And actually, very exciting, they're working on a Coxsackie vaccine for kids at risk for type 1 diabetes. Maybe if they give them that vaccine, then they won't express type 1. They're really working hard on prevention of type 1 diabetes in those at risk. So when we think about type 1, it's an autoimmune condition most commonly expressed ages 10 to 14. It is higher in non-breastfed babies, so we're always encouraging breastfeeding. And then also autoimmunity tends to run in families. So let's just take a look at this incidence of type 1 in youth. You can see if a relative has it, a sibling especially, you're much more likely to get it, or a parent, you get type 1 diabetes. And TrialNet is a trial that's looking to see what is the natural history of type 1, what are the environmental causes of it, and can we halt it in its track. So if you know, and let me just go back to this slide, if you know anybody with type 1 diabetes and their families, really encourage them to go to the TrialNet website. And actually, that's a good reminder. I'll put that on your resource page so you can check that out. Now, normally we can identify if you have type 1 diabetes by presentation. You come in, your breath is fruity, you've lost a lot of weight, your blood sugars are high. But sometimes kids who are overweight and present with symptoms of hyperglycemia, we're not sure they type 1 or type 2, or even adults. Some adults can get type 1 diabetes. I have had patients who are 70 and 80 getting type 1 diabetes. So if we're not sure, I just want to tell you that there's a panel of autoantibodies we can draw. And the ones that we usually draw are the GAD, the ICA, and the IAA. Those are the three. And if those come back positive, we know that person has type 1 diabetes. It's an autoimmune condition. We can verify by positive autoimmune markers. So the ZNT8 is used a lot in clinical trials. I don't see that in the hospital or clinic setting. So that's more in clinical trials. So if you have a patient you're not sure they type 1 or type 2, you could suggest to the provider, can we check a GAD, ICA, or IAA? Those are the three most common. And if one or more comes back positive, so what if not all three come back positive? If one or more comes back positive, we know that person is more likely to have an autoimmune type of diabetes. And I also want to say, as you're doing your histories, you want to ask the patients, do you have a history in your family or within yourself of celiac disease, thyroid disease, Addison's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, or any other autoimmune condition? Because these conditions are associated with type 1 diabetes. People who have these conditions in their family are more likely to get an autoimmune condition like type 1 diabetes. And people with type 1 diabetes are more likely to express these autoimmune conditions. So we're always on the lookout for that. What does type 1 look like? Here's a bunch of fantastic, wonderful, amazing humans from different walks of life who've lived and thrived with type 1 diabetes. And I mean, just as Sonia Sotomayor, how amazing is she? raised in Port, she came from Puerto Rico, had a really tough upbringing, didn't have many resources. English was not even her first language, but she got type 1 diabetes on top of it all, and she became a Supreme Court justice. So type 1 doesn't stop anybody from doing anything. And here's Miss America 1998, Nicole Johnson. And the reason I have her picture is, A, she's been a tremendous advocate for getting out the word about type 1 diabetes, trial net, raising awareness. And also, just to kind of remind us that a lot of women and girls with type 1 diabetes suffer with disordered eating. And when I say that, I want to mention the word diabulimia. Diabulimia. And these are girls with type 1 diabetes, or it could be a boy, but it's more common in women, but it does happen in boys, where they omit their insulin or take less insulin than they need to raise their blood sugar and lose weight. And believe me, they don't have a knowledge deficit. I had one gal who had type 1 diabetes. She was a certified diabetes educator. She was admitted to our hospital with severe gastroparesis and diabetes complications, but she had diabulimia. She was taking less insulin than she needed to keep her weight where she wanted it to be, and she had many, many complications. So we did a lot of getting mental health involved is very important if you detect that. So I just want to be clear. I'm not saying Nicole Johnson has diabulimia, but you can see there's a lot of pressure on women to have a great weight. And sometimes, especially young girls, insulin therapy can cause weight gain. So you can imagine how they would fiddle with their insulin dose to get their weight to where they want it to be. So just be on the lookout for that. I do want to say one thing very important about type 1 diabetes. We've always said, well, type 1, you make no insulin whatsoever. You know, all your beta cells are gone. But that may actually not be true because there's this really amazing study going on at Harvard, the Joslin Diabetes Center, and they looked at these people who've had type 1 diabetes for 50 years, and many of them still produce some insulin. Is that amazing? Many had no eye disease. And you'll meet people like that with type 1 diabetes who, they still have hypoglycemia awareness. They don't get many of the complications of diabetes, even though they've had it for a long time. Maybe their pancreas is still pumping out some juice, and that's what they're thinking. And then other people with type 1 may just not make any more. So really, there's variation within the type 1 diabetes. And I do want to say that you can encourage your patients with type 1 to get this Joslin Medal Award for living with diabetes. You can just go to the Joslin website and apply for it. Type 1 diabetes, in summary, is autoimmune. There's complete pancreatic destruction. The patients will need insulin from the moment they're diagnosed and often first present in ketoacidosis. Let's just take a look at this kid who comes into the hospital. Well, he's not a kid. He's 43. But as I, go up in age, I'm always thinking everybody seems so young to me. He's 43 years old, admitted to evaluate angina. His morning blood sugar is 92. He's got type 1. Based on the hospital regular insulin sliding scale, there's no insulin required. And the breakfast tray shows up and the patient says, hey, I need my insulin before I eat. Yet the scale in the hospital says no insulin until he's 150. What do you say? Exactly. You ask him, tell me what your usual insulin is at home. What dose do you usually take? I'm going to call the provider and get you started back on that in the hospital. He is absolutely right. Since a type 1 makes no insulin, he has to have an insulin injection before he eats, or else his blood sugar is going to go sky high. When I work with people with diabetes, I know they live with their diabetes 24/7. If a patient says to me, if you give me that insulin, I'm going to bottom out, I believe them. Or if they say, that insulin's not going to touch me, I believe them. They know their diabetes better than anyone else. So we want to really engage them in this conversation. Let's move on to type 2 diabetes. If you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them at the end, but we have about a half hour more left, so I want to make sure that we cover the content. But we'll spend some time at the end, and then you can certainly email me with any questions. So let's talk about type 2 diabetes, and here's a very famous singer. You might know who she is. And just like many of us, over time, she put on some weight. She was exercising less. She was busy raising a family. And then one day she woke up, and she was on tour, actually, and she passed out, and they found out she had type 2 diabetes. And she really took this to heart. She turned her life around. She had cookbooks now. She lost a lot of weight and she exercises, a lot. So she took her diabetes diagnosis and says, I'm not going to let this bring me down. I'm going to, just make the best of it. And she really has. This is Patti LaBelle, and she's the gal who has an attitude. If anybody's from the 70s. Oops. And I just want to say one thing about her. She is so cute because she doesn't call herself a diabetic. She's a diva-betic. And that's a mix of diabetic and diva. So, I mean, you can just see a lot of my patients, when they get the news of diabetes, they're frustrated and they're angry, but also they take it as a moment to turn their life around and really make some changes. And so talking about risk of diabetes, as we get older and we gain the weight and our patient and our mom or dad had diabetes, who's at higher risk of expressing diabetes? People with the apple shape or people with the pear shape? And the answer, as you probably know, is people with the apple shape. So these are people who have more abdominal or belly fat. Often we call it visceral fat. And here's a slide that I really think shows it well, that the visceral fat is dangerous because that visceral fat is like an endocrine organ. It's releasing cytokines. It's releasing inflammatory markers. It's making your blood vessels more inflamed and your body more insulin resistant. Visceral fat is not just sitting there doing nothing. It is an active endocrine organ. It's surrounding the liver. It's surrounding the pancreas. It's releasing all kinds of bad stuff. So when we are encouraging our patients with diabetes to lose weight, we're really attacking the visceral fat. And as you know, when they lose body weight, about 50% of each pound is taken away from visceral fat. They'll tell you this all the time. They'll say, oh, I lost weight and my pants felt better, fit better, or I could do my belt a little tighter. They're losing visceral fat, which is awesome. And so visceral fat is the enemy. And you can see, here's a person on the left who's pretty lean, and the person on the right, the visceral fat integrates into the intestines, into the liver, into the pancreas. And that's why it's so dangerous and so insidious. And here's a really amazing, terrific graph of the natural progression of type 2 diabetes, which kind of answers one of the questions we had earlier. But here's 20 years before the diagnosis of diabetes. I am at risk for diabetes. It runs in my family. And I gain some weight. I'm not exercising. And you can see here, my insulin resistance rises. So as I gain weight and I'm exercising less, this is less, 20 years before diagnosis, my insulin resistance rises. And look what my little pancreas is having to do. Pump out more insulin to overcome the resistance. So look at my blood sugars. Oh, sorry about that. Look at my blood sugars. They're staying within target because I'm making enough insulin to overcome this resistance. But over time, my pancreas just says, I cannot keep up with the workload. It's making less insulin. And now look what blood sugars do. They start rising. This is what happens. And then they reach a diagnostic criteria for diabetes. So by the time the person has type 2 diabetes, and this is an old slide, so you can see it's from 2000, we know that about 20% of their pancreas is lost. They're not making enough insulin to get their blood sugars down. And you can see over time, insulin secretion diminishes. So this is why patients will say to you, my metformin isn't working anymore. And then we have to add another medication like, glipizide. And then they put those two, and that doesn't work anymore. Their blood sugars are on the rise. And then we have to add another medication. It's not their fault. They are not failing. It is their pancreas that's failing. And you can see this is a long-term process. The other thing that happens with the rise of blood sugars and insulin resistance is increased risk for heart attack and stroke. And we call this the cardiometabolic risk. You've seen this a million times when you admit a patient in a clinic or outpatient or inpatient, wherever it is, and it will say, and they come in for a heart attack or stroke, for example. Patient has a history of hyperlipidemia, hypertension, hyperglycemia. Those come together very frequently because they are a syndrome, a clustering of risk factors that often co-present. And the seed of this is hyperinsulinemia. There's insulin resistance, so the pancreas has to over-release insulin to compensate for the resistance. And then after the pancreas can't keep up with the workload, we have hyperglycemia. And then you add on to that hyperlipidemia with, you'll see a lot of high triglyceride levels and high LDL. Sometimes the LDLs can be normal, but they have very high, very low density lipoprotein, a VLDL. Their blood pressure goes up, and their waistline goes up. I made that one up. That's not an actual word. So these, as when we measure waistlines, we're actually measuring visceral adiposity. That's what we're measuring. So as the waistline goes up, we're gathering more visceral adiposity. Our insulin resistance goes up, and this whole situation is activated. And that's why when we meet people with diabetes, newly diagnosed, we're going to say, we got to lose some weight. That is such a key priority because it helps decrease the resistance and helps protect the beta cells. So I just want to say, if you meet a patient with heart disease, vascular disease, infections, look at their lipids, look at their hypertension, look at their blood sugars, because they're probably going to manifest many of these at abnormally high levels. So let's just think about who is at risk for type 2 diabetes. And this is a very important if you're taking the exam to be familiar at who's at risk, who should be tested, what are the risk factors. And that's on that sheet I mentioned, the criteria and diagnostic sheet I have on the resource page for you. But we should test anybody at risk for diabetes if they're overweight. So the first risk factor, if somebody is overweight, BMI of 25 or greater, and they have one additional risk factor, we should check their blood sugar. It used to say if they're 45 and older with a BMI of 25, they got rid of the 45 and older because we're getting it younger and younger. I have 30-year-olds coming into my clinic with type 2 diabetes. So if the BMI is 25 or greater and they have any of these other risk factors, we need to check their blood sugar. It's so, so important, especially women who had gestational diabetes or a big baby or polycystic ovary syndrome, very high risk for diabetes in the future. We want to check their blood sugar, very important. Now, I had on the last slide, if anybody has acanthosis nigricans, we need to check their blood sugar. What is acanthosis nigricans? Well, it's a manifestation on the skin of insulin resistance. So the skin can manifest insulin resistance by getting very dark, velvety. The person might start getting little skin tags. And I'm just going to show you a picture. Here's what it looks like. So you've seen these necks. You've seen this in the underarm. You've seen this in the groin, under the breast. Between on the ankles, on the knees, where the body parts rub or bend is where you'll see a manifestation of acanthosis nigricans. Now, how do we get rid of this? Well, the main treatment is reducing insulin resistance. So as we help the person get active, lose weight, exercise, the acanthosis nigricans diminishes. Also, they can take metformin. That might help decrease their insulin resistance. But just be on the lookout for this. If you work in a school or with kids, the moms will say, hey, I try to scrub my kid's neck or his knees or his elbow. It won't come clean. It's not going to come clean. It's a thickening of the skin, which signals insulin resistance. And if they manifest that, we've got to check their blood sugar. I've mentioned this already. We need your work. We need your help. We need diabetes detectives to find those people who are living with diabetes and don't know it. Because the truth is, from studies that we've seen, the earlier we catch it, the more aggressively we manage it, the better the outcomes are in the long run. I just want to go over the ominous octet then. This is a summary slide of all of what's broken with type 2 diabetes. The first thing is the pancreas isn't working good. 80% loss at diagnosis. We know that. And then there's increased glucose production from the liver. The liver is just pumping out glucose. And insulin and metformin really help with that. There's increased lipolysis. So that means there's not as much triglyceride storage. There's more free fatty acids. The fat cells are resistant to insulin. So it's just this whole array of dysfunction on different organs. There's increased glucagon secretion. I mentioned that the pancreas squirts out extra glucagon, and glucagon raises insulin resistance and raises blood sugars. The muscles in particular reject insulin and reject sugar. So that's why exercise is critical. And also I talk to my patients a lot about weights. When you weightlift or do weight-bearing activities, you burn sugar. And I had this gal, she's in my class, she's 90 years old. She couldn't really walk that well anymore because of she had arthritis and other joint issues. But she got some barbells, and every commercial she was lifting those two-pound weights, it really helped her blood sugars. Whatever we can do. Decrease gut hormones. So people with diabetes type 2 make less gut hormones. They don't get the satiety response. They may eat more than they intended to. and a decreased neurotransmission to the brain. And last but not least is the kidneys are messed up, because with diabetes, the kidneys reabsorb blood sugar. Usually it's called a renal threshold for glucose. When your blood sugar is higher than 180, you spill it. But with diabetes, that renal threshold is upregulated. And it's not until the blood sugars are 210 does the kidneys release the sugar. So the kidneys are reabsorbing sugar when the blood sugar is already too high. And there's a new type of medication we'll talk about in class 5 called the SGLT2 inhibitors, or Invokana, Farxiga, that tell the kidneys, release the sugar. We don't need it. We're high enough as it is. So just to kind of sum up the difference between type 1 and type 2. Type 2, more likely to be overweight or obese. Type 1, insulin dependent. They need insulin from the get-go. Type 2s, about 30% of them need insulin. Who responds to oral agents? Our type 1s don't at all, but our type 2s do. Ketosis, or burning of fat for fuel, normally seen in our type 1s. Antibodies present only in our type 1s. Our type 2s will never have autoantibodies. Theirs is not an autoimmune disease. Typical age of onset, as you know, for type 1, it's teenagers, but it can happen at any time during the lifespan. And for our type 2s, it's the adults. And who's insulin resistant? Our type 2s are. But I do want to say one thing, and it comes to mind because I just had a patient in the clinic. She has type 1 diabetes, and she's been on insulin for 40 years. But her mom had type 2 diabetes, and she's really struggling with weight. And I just looked at her and I said, you know what? I think you have type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And it is true they can coexist. I went to the ADA postgrad conference and they were saying that 25% of all type 1s also have type 2. So they can have both conditions. So not only are they insulin deficient, they're insulin resistant. More complicated to manage. The other thing about diabetes is it's not only associated with hyperglycemia. There's other comorbidities associated with it that you may or may not expect, like fatty liver disease. Many of our patients with diabetes have fatty liver. Their hepatocytes are just chock full of fat, and that can lead to liver disease over time. They may have obstructive sleep apnea, and cancers are more common in our patients with diabetes, especially pancreas, liver, and breast. Another thing about diabetes is that in the brain, insulin is a neurotransmitter. And if you have diabetes, you make less insulin, so they're more likely to get Alzheimer's and dementia and depression. And we don't have time to talk about all of those today, but as we go through, we'll talk about that more. And actually, I have an online course called Critical Assessment that really talks about those different disease conditions related to diabetes, if you're interested. To kind of wrap up, we have two more types of diabetes to talk about, and that's gestational diabetes and diabetes due to other reasons. Now, if you don't work in Sweet Success or don't work with women who are pregnant with diabetes, you know, this, you may say, well, this isn't really relevant to me, but actually it's really relevant to all of us because gestational diabetes has been increasing over the past 20 years. You can see it's increased by 10 to 100%, especially in certain populations. Now, the reason this is concerning to all of us is because, as I've mentioned before, if a woman gets gestational diabetes after pregnancy, her risk of getting diabetes is 5 to 10% within 2 years. Or immediately after she delivers. But within 5 years, she has a 50% chance of developing diabetes. So what I want to say is there are a lot of good research coming out now that we can help decrease the prevalence of gestational diabetes. And how do we do that? By helping women move into pregnancy at healthy weights, number one. So being at a healthy weight when you get pregnant, and also during pregnancy, not gaining too much weight. Those two actions by themselves will help decrease gestational diabetes. If we decrease gestational diabetes, you can see we decrease fetal complications and we decrease obesity and diabetes in that kid's life later on. And so I think that mothers are very motivated if we let them know you can improve the health legacy of your kids by having a great weight when you start pregnancy and not gaining too much weight, you're giving a gift to your children that will last a lifetime, and it'll be passed on to their children. So I think we want to start framing this message early on to really encourage women to be at their best place when they get pregnant and really take good care of themselves during pregnancy. And so what we say now, the recommendations are in flux and changing and controversial and all of that stuff. And if you are taking the exam, I would always be very familiar with the American Diabetes Association recommendations. That's most of the time what the exam will pull off of. But for any woman who is pregnant, we're going to screen for undiagnosed type 2 diabetes if they have any of the risk factors we've mentioned before, if they're overweight, BMI 25 or greater, and they have one other risk factor. And some clinics are just saying, when people are told they're pregnant, let's just check their blood sugar and see what it is. Because it's very important. We don't want that fetus exposed to high levels of glucose early in its development. It can wreak a lot of havoc with congenital abnormalities. So if the women, if we screen them, and then we find out they have higher than normal levels of blood sugar, when they first find out they're pregnant, they have diabetes. They have type 2 diabetes. That's what they have. And so now they have diabetes in pregnancy, and we'll have to follow them and keep their blood sugar at target throughout their pregnancy. But if their blood sugar is normal, we're going to recheck them at 24 to 28 weeks. And on that sheet I provided for you, it has a criteria for how we diagnose gestational diabetes. But the main point I want to reach out to all of you is talking about gestational diabetes from a public health perspective, and that is if we can focus on our women of childbearing age and before that on prevention, we can make a big difference. And after delivery, if we can encourage breastfeeding, that would be so terrific. About 25% of women are breastfeeding for 1 year. About 70% of women after they deliver are breastfeeding, but it drops off over time. So we're getting more and more women to initiate breastfeeding, and we need to really consider making breastfeeding more easy for women to do in the workplace to encourage ongoing breastfeeding for that year goal. The other thing that's really important is we need to encourage women to get screened for diabetes 6 to 12 weeks after delivery. A lot of women are busy and they don't have time to do it, but it's very important to follow up with them. So women and who have gestational diabetes, we want to follow them closely over time and really encourage them for subsequent pregnancies to get to a healthy weight, not gain too much weight, because just because they had GDM in the first pregnancy doesn't mean they're going to have it in the subsequent one. So give them hope. But if we can't prevent it, that's better. And I do want to say that if a woman had gestational diabetes and then after she delivers, she has prediabetes, so that fasting blood sugar 100 to 125, we do encourage them to start on metformin therapy. So that is an ADA recommendation for women with prediabetes who had GDM. Consider metformin therapy because they are at such high risk for rolling over to diabetes. We're going to pull out all the stops, including exercise, weight loss, but medication is going to be an aspect of that too. Our last cause of diabetes is called other causes of hyperglycemia. And I know you've seen this in whatever work situation you're in. Patients on steroids, tube feedings, transplants, cystic fibrosis. That, especially steroids, can really make patients more insulin resistant. When they become more insulin resistant, their blood sugars go up. So the steroid is immunosuppressant, and then if they're on steroids, they're insulin resistant and they're immunosuppressed, then you add extra sugar into their blood, you can see they're at much higher risk for infection. And so my main point of this slide is regardless of the cause of hyperglycemia, we still need to treat their blood sugars. We need to get them down, and usually we'll use insulin therapy if it's for temporary. Sometimes orals will work, but insulin will always work. And the other thing I want to mention is it's a sign of pancreatic malfunction, because if the person can't get their blood sugar to target under a stress situation, I know their pancreas is underperforming. You know, their pancreas just doesn't have enough juice to get blood sugars under control. So when this intervention is stopped, I'm going to monitor them very closely for diabetes in the future. And sometimes when we stop the intervention, their blood sugars stay high. The main point is, regardless of the cause, we have to treat. Let's take a look at this case study. Mrs. Jones is 62 years old. She's overweight, and she's complaining of feeling tired and urinating several times a night. She comes into the hospital with a UTI. Her white count is high. Her blood sugar is 237. She is hypertensive with a history of GDM, no ketones. So let's just go over together, what are some of her risk factors for getting diabetes? You're right, she's 62. So the older we get, the more likely we are to have diabetes. She's overweight. Any other risk factors? Hypertensive, exactly. So if you're hypertensive, you're at higher risk for diabetes. And she had gestational diabetes, all risk factors. Now let's take a look at what signs of diabetes does she have. Well, go ahead. That's right. She's complaining of feeling tired and urinating a lot. What other signs? UTI is a sign of diabetes. And her blood sugar is 237. That's a random blood sugar. And as we discussed, a blood sugar 200 or greater is indicative of diabetes. So certainly, it looks like she has diabetes. So now she's like, you know what? I came to the hospital and I came in for UTI and you people gave me diabetes. Have you ever heard that? Well, we actually didn't give her diabetes, but it was the UTI happened because she was having ongoing hyperglycemia, and that UTI was a signal to her that something's wrong and that she's has diabetes. We've got to treat it. And we know she has insulin resistance. How do we know that? Because her blood sugars are elevated and she's overweight. So we don't test for insulin resistance. We just know it because of their body weight, the visceral adiposity, and high blood sugars indicate that the pancreas can't keep up for the job. And here's some questions I just put for you that you might want to consider on your own. She's asking you, what is this diabetes? Will it go away? Will I get complications? And these are common questions people ask us. And then she asks you, do I have to check my blood sugars? And, you know, in the hospital, we're checking it 4 times a day. And she's like, I'm going to have to go home and poke myself all the time. And she doesn't want to. And I know you've met patients like that who are like, why do I have to check my blood sugars? And all this diabetes stuff is overwhelming for me. And so to kind of conclude this webinar, I want to just share with you some ideas or strategies if you're running into roadblocks like that. And the first thing is, nobody wants to get diabetes. And people many times feel guilty, like it's their fault. They feel ashamed. Maybe if I would have done something different, I wouldn't have this diabetes. And so we really want to let them know it is not your fault you have diabetes. It's nothing you've done wrong. It's your genetics. And yes, it is true over time as you gain weight and exercise less, those genes are going to express themselves. But if you don't have the genes for diabetes, you can't get it. So I don't guilt people. I don't make, you know, I really focus on what they can do to improve the situation and that they have the power and the ability to control this diabetes. I'm going to support them and help them. I'm going to do everything I can in my power to reach them in the way that they can hear me. And so for this gal who doesn't want to check her blood sugars, I'm going to ask her why. And then what I'm going to find out when she says, well, I'm afraid it's going to hurt. Okay, well, I'm going to teach you techniques so it doesn't hurt or it hurts less. So I want to be clear about this. Poking your finger does hurt. So I'm going to teach you techniques that will help it hurt less, like poking on the side and not using alcohol and so forth, and changing your Lancet on a regular basis. And I've had this slide up for a while, but I went to the ADA meeting, and Ann Peters, a provider, said, you know what, after each visit, I hug my patients. And I'm like, wow, this is terrific. And she goes, you know, she physically hugs them, but she also helps with unconditional guidance and support. And the truth is, and this is Bill Polansky, who's another leader in diabetes and looking at, you know, people who we might term noncompliant. I don't really personally believe in noncompliance. I believe that people are struggling with barriers, and they're struggling with psychological barriers, financial barriers, and other personal obstacles. So no one is unmotivated to lead a long and healthy life. Most of our patients, if we search hard enough, you know, have reasons why they want to have the best health possible. So look for these critical barriers. And one is perceived worthlessness. Why should I check my blood sugars? Why should I eat right? It's not going to change anything. Yes, it will. And you want to let people know this very important thing. Just because you have diabetes does not mean you're going to get complications. Diabetes doesn't cause complications. Uncontrolled diabetes causes complications. Such an important message. If you do the work of getting your blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol to target, your chance of complications are minimized. It's worth the work. So we want to find out, what are the barriers stopping people? What about support, resources, money? Do they have access to medical care? Do they have a team that they can work with? We want to find out what those barriers are. And then we want to overcome the barriers, confront the misbelief, offer patients a message of hope. And, you know, frequent contact. I know we're super busy, but even if we see them in our office initially and then we phone call them up, hey, how are you doing? How are things going? It makes a big difference in outcomes. So here's some other, oh, this paired glucose testing, and I use this a lot. I'll say to patients, you know what? I know you're really struggling with exercise. Would you be willing to check your blood sugars before you exercise and then check them afterward and see what exercise does to your blood sugars? And when they start doing that, they realize exercise is like a medication. Would you be willing to, you know, just adjust your carbohydrates in your meal a little bit, maybe cut back a little bit at dinner time, and let's see how that affects your post-meal blood sugars? We want to engage them in this experiment and a trial and error and looking at their blood sugars. We don't want people just to check their blood sugars to check them. We want them to have meaning. And we want them to know how it's going to help them. As adult learners, just like you all, you want to know, how is it going to help me? And if it isn't going to help me, why should I do it? That's such a legitimate question, and we need to give them responses. So it's going to help see if your plan is working, avoid unwanted weight gain. You're going to feel better, feel less depressed, have more energy, and you won't be going to the bathroom all the time. And then when patients are asking us, how often should I check, we want to be realistic. In the hospital, we check 4 times a day, but I do want to tell you, Medicare covers, if you have type 2 diabetes and you're not on insulin, it covers 1 strip a day. Medicare covers 1 strip a day or 100 strips for 3 months. So if we're asking patients to check more than that, they may have to pay out of pocket, and those strips cost $1 each. They're very expensive. So type 2 as needed to achieve goals. If I have a patient on metformin, their A1C is 6.3, and they want to check twice a week, great. That's perfect. Check twice a week. Your blood sugars are at target. You're doing great. I don't want them to have to check more than they need. But what if they're a type 2 on insulin 4 times a day? Well, Medicare will cover 4 strips a day in that situation. They're going to need to check a lot more often. So we base that work on what their needs are. We don't want to have them do stuff for no reason. We want to be thoughtful about it. And type 1s need to check as often as needed, you know, up to 8 to 10 times a day. And the new meters are so exciting. When I first started in diabetes, we had to get this big drop of blood. Now the drop is so tiny. And make sure that your patients know how to use their meters and that there's a 1-800 number available to answer any questions on the back. So we want to watch our patients check their blood sugar, give them any feedback, make sure they check on the side and not in the center, and they don't need to use alcohol. Soap and water is totally acceptable. So I just want to thank all of you so much for joining us. And we have about a few more minutes, so I'll answer some questions. But I do want to say that there's a resource page where we've put a lot of different resources. You can look at those. And if you have any other questions, let me know if we don't answer them right now. And we'll be sending out another link for next week's broadcast. Next week's broadcast is on June 18th. And plan on checking in 5 to 10 minutes before the program just to get situated and make sure everything's working right, but you can join at any time. And to receive your CE credit, you just need to log into your Diabetes Education University student portal, and we'll be posting this recorded version in the university so you can listen to it there online, and then there's a post-test and a survey. Once you complete those, then you get your CE certificate. Before we wrap up, I do have a few more questions I'd like to ask you for our polls. Let me see if I have any we haven't answered yet. There is one. Erectile, this is part of my diet bingo questions. Erectile dysfunction, if a patient comes into you and they're having erectile dysfunction, indicates what? Increased risk of bladder cancer, heart disease, marital discord, or bladder infection? Which one do you think is the right answer? I had a lot of fun writing these questions. I said, I'm going to put one funny answer in each of my questions. Okay, well, 67% of you have voted, so let's go ahead and share your results. It is true that men with diabetes who have erectile dysfunction It is an indicator for heart disease because if there's not good blood flow to the penis, there's not good blood flow to the heart. So erectile dysfunction can cause marital discord, but the most important thing about this is you want to address it and talk about it and ask our patients about erectile dysfunction because it can be an indicator of increased risk of heart disease. One last question, and this is, each percentage point of A1C, so A1C is a 3-month average, but what does one percentage point of A1C represent as far as blood sugar? And so I always tell my patients, wow, you dropped your A1C, 3 points. That means you dropped your blood sugars. How much? Okay. Just take 1 second to vote, and I'm going to go ahead and close this poll. Okay, I'm really glad we're talking about this because each one percentage point of A1C equals 29 points of blood sugar. So if our patients drop their A1C by one percentage point, they've dropped their blood sugar 29 points, and that's a big deal. Each 1% drop of A1C reduces risk of complications, so it's worth the work. In your resource page, I have listed all the Diet Bingo questions there, so if you want to do a little review and answer those, you can. And I put together these questions because they're often asked on the exam. So thank you so much for joining. I really appreciate your participation and you being here. I know you have busy schedules. If you have any questions, you can email me or visit our website. And what I'm going to do right now, as I promised, is I'm going to stop the recording and then take your questions, and we'll spend, 10 minutes or so answering any questions you might have. So thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.